Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 38th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is why we should read Faulkner now. I'm joined by Michael Gora. He's the author of The Saddest Words, William Faulkner's Civil War. The publisher is Livewright Publishing, a division of W.W. Norton and Company. The author of Portrait of a Novel, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, Michael is the Mary Augusta Jordan Professor of English Language and Literature at Smith College and the editor of the Norton critical editions of As I Lay Dying and The Sound and the Fury. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. So I'm curious about the book's title. Can you maybe talk about that in part of giving us a brief introductory sense of this book?
Sure, of course. So the title is The Saddest Words, and there are two of them. The words are was and again. And they come, they're used in The Sound and the Fury, in the second part of that novel, which is a dramatic monologue in the first-person voice of a character named Quentin Compson. He's a boy from Mississippi. He's a freshman at Harvard. And at the end of his monologue, he's going to commit suicide. What he's doing in that monologue is he's remembering his earlier life as he goes around his day in Cambridge. He's remembering his earlier life and some conversations he's had with his father earlier that summer when the conversations have been about his sister Caddy, who is pregnant, promiscuous, marrying somebody who's not the father of her child. And he's talking to his father, and his father says, essentially, you're going to get over this. This isn't always going to trouble you the way it does now. And Quentin won't have any of that. He thinks that this is permanent, that the anguish, the agony he's going through, the sense of lost family honor he's going through, that's going to be forever. And his father then says, was the saddest word of all. Because was, when you can think of something as was, well, it means it's in the past. You have started to get over it. It's no longer as present to you. It's not is. So that's one word. But at another point in his monologue, Quentin thinks to himself, no, was isn't the saddest word. Again. That's the saddest word. Again. Sadder than was. Saddest of all. Because what again means, that word again, is that things repeat themselves. They go on happening. You might think you've gotten over it, and then boom, it's back. Trauma returns. The present or that past that seems to you so present keeps on replaying itself for you. And part of my argument is that this is what, for a writer like Faulkner, for an American writer, as a writer from the American South in the early years of the 20th century, that's what the Civil War was. It was, again, something that you had been taught, that you'd absorbed, that you believed was not fully over, that you still felt the pain of that loss as something ongoing, something present. And you were encouraged to do that. That's what your textbooks told you to do. The lost cause that was somehow still alive. And Faulkner was troubled by that. He didn't really believe in, he didn't believe in slavery. He didn't believe in the Confederacy. But he nevertheless absorbed that worldview growing up as a boy in Mississippi.
Sure. No, I think that's fascinating stuff. I admit, when I was reading your book, I thought back to a Delmar Schwartz quote that hasn't been in my mind recently until now, which is, the past is inevitable.
Right.
Because that's such a presence in your book. Now, you mentioned several times that Faulkner, you know, you used the phrase a wound of the mind. I'm not sure which novel that's in or if that's your own words. You also said Faulkner believed in failure. Can you maybe elucidate on that?
Yeah. Well, again, this goes back to The Sound of the Fury. The wound of the mind is my phrase, in fact, and I'm borrowing it actually from Freudian analysis. Faulkner believed in failure in that he'd grown up in a world in which not a lot of people were succeeding. His father had failed in a number of businesses. He himself hadn't finished high school. He'd had no profession. He was regarded as a good for nothing by people in his extended family. Well, when he was writing The Sound of the Fury, he'd published two novels, and then he had another novel rejected, a book on which he's got a great deal of hope. It's called Flags in the Dust. And it was rejected. His publisher said, you shouldn't even try to publish this anywhere else. It'll destroy what little reputation you have. I think it's actually a marvelous novel. It was published in an abridged form some months later. And now we do read the original version. But he felt like he was a failure as a writer. And yet in failure, he found a set of creative possibilities. He then said to himself, okay, well, I'm not going to be published. Let's play and let's go for broke. So he started to tell this impossible story about a family. And he thought he would tell the first part. He would tell the story over and over again. He first told it from the point of view of Quentin Compson's younger brother, Benji, who's mentally impaired, who can't speak, and who can't tell the difference between past and present. So Faulkner told the family history of the sister's pregnancy and so on from Benji's point of view. And then he said, no, that's not working. So he told it from Quentin's point of view, from the point of view of the suicide. And he said, no, that's not working. He told it from the point of view of a third brother who is coldly irrational and just as crazy as the others, though actually here. The person he didn't tell it from, the point of view he didn't choose to tell it from, was that of the sister. He let her stay off the page as this object of desire, this figure whom never actually appears, but whom the three brothers can't stop thinking of. He told the story three times, and he said, none of them are really working, so I'll try it. I'll let Faulkner do it, he said. I'll let Faulkner do it. And what he did in the last section of the novel was to retell the story in an omniscient third person, but concentrating on the lives of the family's black servants, and especially on their cook, Dilsey Gibson, who's been with them for many, many years. This is set in 1928. And then he said, okay, well, that's enough. He threw up his hands and said, it's failed. But each time I failed a little better.
Well, I'm glad for one that he went for broke, so to speak, because it's one of my favorite novels. Yeah. You mentioned that there was a civil war within Faulkner himself. Right. I'm also curious about that comic. Can you tease that out a bit more for us?
Sure. Well, having killed Quentin Compson off in The Sound of the Fury, Faulkner couldn't quite let him alone. And Faulkner really could never let any story or any of his characters alone. The one thing that people know two things about him. One is that his books are difficult, and they are. The other thing is that he set just about all his fiction in the same imaginary county in Mississippi, which is modeled on his own Lafayette County in the northern part of the state, and that he tended to draw on the same characters over and over again. You know, he'd start a story in one book and finish it in another. He'd come up with a different anecdote about a particular set of characters that he wanted you to know. So he you know, 8 years after The Sound of the Fury, he went back to Quentin Compson, pushes the narrative back 6 months. It's December in 1909. The boy's going to kill himself 6 months further on, but he's not dead yet. And what Faulkner does is to imagine Quentin as being asked over and over again at Harvard, being asked to tell about the South. You got all these Yankees saying, Yankees like me, saying, tell about the South. What's it like there? What do people do there? How do they live there? And even says, why do they live at all? And what Quentin then does is he tells a story. Since he's been telling a story all fall, but there's one night on which he sits down with his roommate, who's a Canadian, and they tell the story again, and they swap it back and forth. And it's a story. It's a story about slavery. It's a story that goes back to the earliest days of the settlement of Faulkner's imaginary county, a place he called Yoknapatawpha County. It's a word my students can never pronounce. About half our first class on Faulkner was getting, okay, say it with me, Yoknapatawpha. He tells a story about the early settlement of Yoknapatawpha, about the coming of the war, about one plantation family and the way they first make a great fortune, and then the past catches up with them. And I'm not going to say in just what form the past catches up with them, because that's part of the genius of the book, is it keeps you guessing, except that it does have to do with sex. The past catching up with you in Faulkner almost always has to do with sex in some way. The past catches up with them, and Faulkner takes this story as indicative of the history of the South, or Quentin takes it as indicative of the history of the South. He finishes the story in the last page of the book. His roommate says, okay, now tell me one thing more. Just why do you hate the South? Just why do you hate it so much? And Quentin says, I don't hate it. And you sense his voice rising, and you know, and you don't believe what he's saying. That there's a part of him that loves that place, but a part of him that also hates it. And Faulkner said in interviews, he said, "Well, that's the character. That's not me." Other places he came a little more clean and said, you know, admitted, "Yeah, there are parts. There are parts I love. There are parts I hate." And what he hates above all is the way in which his people, white Southerners, have treated the black Southerners they live with and on whom they depend. So there's a part of him that is he's the descendant of slave owners. He accepted in many ways the sort of codes of manners and the hierarchy that he'd inherited and that he lived in. He also knew it was deeply and profoundly unjust. And I think he was always troubled by that contradiction. It's a contradiction in himself as much as it is in the society around him. So that's part of the Civil War in him.
Okay. I'm also curious, and I don't want to spend too much time on the man himself necessarily, but many times there are at least passing references to the fact, if I'm not mistaken, that Faulkner was an alcoholic. Yeah. How does that play into his writing style, into his novels? Anything you might want to say on that front?
Yeah, you know, Faulkner was not only an alcoholic, he was a third-generation alcoholic. His grandfather, his paternal grandfather, his father, actually he married an alcoholic as well. His wife Estelle was an alcoholic. There was a code of drinking in his world. What nobody has ever really defined fully, I think, is the degree to which Faulkner was drinking while he was writing. I don't think he was the sort of person who had a glass by him when he was at the typewriter. He was a binge drinker when he was done. When he was finished with a book, he might go on a bender. And then sometimes he knew when he had to dry out as well. There was a particular drying out facility in the northern Mississippi. It's where he died, in fact, in early 1962. He would check himself in there and dry out. He was a binge drinker. Sometimes he would have accidents from drinking. There's one moment, I forget what year it is, when he was visiting his publishers in New York and passed out and fell against a steam pipe and lay there for an hour or so and had to be hospitalized. Wow. After that. But I don't think he was drinking as he wrote. End of the day, a little bit, perhaps, when the books were done, then. It did take a toll on him over time, though. It really did take a toll on him over time, that his constitution, it weakened his constitution. He died of a heart attack, which at 64, 65, which he probably was helped along by the alcoholism. He was prone to falls of one kind or another as he got older. He insisted on riding horses and rode them rather foolhardily and often fell off. It certainly took a toll, and you could argue, in fact, that really all the great Faulkner books they're finished by the time he's 45. He's got another 20 years, but none of the books he wrote after Go Down Moses, to my mind, are comparable in their scope and quality to the earlier ones. It's not to say they're not fun. They are fun. They're engaging. They fill in pieces of the mythology of the world he's created in Yom Kippur Tov. But the later half dozen books are not on the same order as the books he wrote between, say, 1928 and 1942.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, it's a tremendous span. I admit that after I finished the book and was reflecting on the title and this civil war within Faulkner, I went online to Google and I looked up photographs of Faulkner because I'm a facial coder, which means that professionally I study people's facial muscle movements to understand the emotions that they show, including characteristic emotions. And in Faulkner's case, the corners of his mouth turned down, a sign of sadness. His eyes rarely meet the camera. They tend to be down. Very slight smile, otherwise really no smiles in the photographs I happened to look at. And his eyebrow arches a bit in a sign of surprise and fear. So one gets a sense of a man who's certainly not elated. There is some determination on his face in terms of some anger. But there is a downcast quality to him without doubt. Go ahead. You wanted to say something there.
That is fascinating. Does that increase over the course of his life, or is that consistent from photographs that, say, were taken in the 1920s?
I didn't, check the chronology the way they were presented to me on Google. I couldn't really do that readily. I could kind of guess at his age. I would say it was fairly consistent from the ones that I looked at. I could go back. I'd be fascinated, in fact, to go back and look more. Another alcoholic writer, F. Scott Fitzgerald from my neck of the woods, Minnesota, also had problems with sadness. But increasingly, in his case, he was actually fairly upbeat initially.
So this is really just gossip, but I was in Mississippi. I was visiting Oxford, where Faulkner had lived, and there's a retired faculty member of the University of Mississippi there who took me to visit Faulkner's grave. And he said that he had been talking with, I think it was had been maybe Faulkner's son-in-law or a nephew or something. And he said, at least he could tell, he'd hardly ever had a happy day in his life.
Yeah.
Say a day of sort of unalloyed happiness. And that's a sort of, biographical thing you can't really testify to. But that fits with that what you're saying about reading the face.
It's rich territory.
That's really fascinating to me.
So, I have not actually read Absalom. I have read As I Lay Dying, love it. Sound of the Fury, one of my favorite novels. I've read Light in August. I've read Barn Burning and other short stories. But you say in the book that to your mind, for your money, Absalom is right up there with another of my favorite books, The Golden Bull by Henry James and Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Is it the difficulty of what they dare to take on? Is it the style? What is it that makes that novel of his, Faulkner's, a cut above Sound of the Fury, which, you know, is to my mind certainly a great novel?
Right. Well, you know, it's the difficulty. It's the scope of what they take on. You know, The Sound of the Fury is a magnificent book. It's a magnificent book. I think it gains in historical resonance from being put up against the books that Faulkner wrote afterwards. That is, there are things in The Sound of the Fury about the past, about race, about history, that are, as it were, almost latent in that novel. They're latent in that they're lying out there waiting to be given meaning, and the later books give them meaning. And I think Absalom certainly does that. You read Absalom and go back to The Sound of the Fury, and you'll see things there in that earlier book you wouldn't have seen without it. Now, it is Absalom is, I think, more difficult, not on a sentence by sentence level. There's not quite the same experimentation with subjective consciousness that there is in The Sound and the Fury, although some of its sentences are brutally long and difficult. But I think it's conceptually more difficult. It's more demanding. It keeps Sound of Fury is in many places very funny. There's not much humor in Absalom. It keeps you at a sustained rhetorical high pitch for 300 pages. Teetering right on the edge of falling over into too much, and in that sense, it's he called As I Lay Dying a tour de force, but as Absalom is every bit as much of a tour de force. It's a sustained exercise, and I guess I call it the sublime. It's a scary book to read. It feels like you've been knocked over the head. Your mind has been blasted open. Moby Dick does that too in places. The Golden Bowl does. The Golden Bowl is a book that James's Golden Bowl, you have to be, that's a book to read in the morning when you're at your, when you're at your most alert. And you know, the Sound of the Fury will wound you. Nobody's going to be entirely happy when they read that book, but as I say in my own book, that when you read it, you realize this is why we do read, to get books like this.
So with Absalom, and again, I haven't read the book, but from your many points of discussion of it within your book, I gather that it's about a planter's sexual abuse of his slaves. And I must say, although it didn't catch my attention earlier in life, now the question of mixed race, miscegenation, a term that's been used in the past, Mississippi Code about what constitutes being a white person, all of these things start to well up. And the sexual abuse to me is daring for the time he wrote it. It is so central to all the racial issues that still are with us today. What more could you say about that issue and how that helps give the book the punch that it does?
Yeah, if you could see me, I was nodding along as you spoke. You're right that these are not issues that fiction in Faulkner's day dealt with comfortably or indeed at all. It's not something you're going to find in Gone with the Wind, which was published the very same year. But it is, yes, about, among other things, about the planter's sexual abuse of his slaves, about the children he fathered on his slaves, about what defines a white person legally, as well as in the minds of those around you. All these things that, as you say, are indeed very much present with us now. When we were in school, people didn't want to admit that what we all know now to be the truth about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. We're more willing to look at those things now. Now, another thing I would say is that, very curiously, in the early days of Faulkner criticism in the 50s and 60s, nobody really paid much attention to those issues as well when they read Absalom, Absalom. And that's part of the way criticism worked then. People concentrated on the formal aspects of the novel, on the various ways in which our knowledge of the past comes to us, looking at moments of conflicting testimony in the novel, because the novel is made up of different characters telling their versions of the past. They asked, well, what warrant do we have for believing the stories we're told about this planter, Thomas Sutpen, and his sexual history? Well, it's just one character's word. There's no, quote, objectivity there. They didn't really look very, critics then really didn't look very closely at what the book was saying about the South, at its historical resonance. And now, of course, even as we're still aware of all those complicated narratological issues, we're much more willing to look at that thematic burden, to ask what the novel's about. Why might Quentin hate the South so much? Why might this be the story he picks to tell what the South is like to Northerners? A story of race and slavery and sexual exploitation and property. It is not something people wanted to talk about very much in the 1930s. The 1930s, Jim Crow is still going strong in the South. There is the myth of the lost cause is still going strong. There is an attempt by a lot of historians to paint slavery as a more or less benign institution. One we're happy to see is over, but it was more or less benign. It was sort of like an English country house with the servants gathered around, and servants was the word that they used to refer to slaves. It's the word they used in the slavery period itself, but they kept on being used. So this was not something that people in Faulkner's Mississippi wanted to hear about. And a lot of libraries in Mississippi wouldn't put Faulkner in there because he told too many uncomfortable truths. They thought he was somebody, even his uncle said that he was writing dirty books to sell the Yankees. It was a bold book.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So before we run out of time here, there's at least one, maybe two more questions I want to get to. One is, you make reference to Edmund Wilson's Patriotic Gore, which is a book I have not read, but intend to now that I've read your book, because you bring it up. How do you think your book owes maybe some debt to that? How does it build on that book? I mean, I know yours is specifically to Faulkner, right, but obviously both touch on the Civil War.
Well, Edmund Wilson's Patriotic Gore is a book published in the early 1960s on the literature of the Civil War, or rather what we'd call the writing that came out of the Civil War, because part of what Wilson says is the Civil War did not produce great novels or poems, not in the generations immediately following the war. I mean, I think it clearly produced a great novel in Absalom, Absalom, but that's 60, 70 years later. So there's no War and Peace about the Civil War. There's no great novelist who fought in the Civil War. So what Wilson does is say, well, what writing did come out of the war? And he looks at diaries and memoirs and letters. He looks at some poems which were popular in this post-Civil War period. Even if they're not much read now, he looks at oratories, speeches. He looks a lot at Lincoln. He looks at Grant's memoirs. he brought attention to two significant works that really are not part of the canon of 19th century literature. And one is indeed those memoirs of Grant's, which were wildly popular when they were published and then more or less forgotten about. And then the diary of the upper class South Carolina woman, Mary Chestnut, whose husband had been a United States senator and who left a record of life in the upper reaches of the Confederacy that is wonderfully detailed. And Wilson said, you know, this book really is great literature. So when I began my book, I thought, well, I'm going to try to update Edmund Wilson. I'm going to try to take on all the literature about the Civil War that's been produced since and bring him up to date. And after a little while, I took a deep swallow. I thought, well, but I can take a writer I already do know and whose work I love, Faulkner, and see what he has to say about the war. I can see what he has to say about the war and what the war can tell us about him. I can use them to read each other. And in doing so, also to say some things about our own moment.
Sure. So my last question then, and we probably could have taken half an hour just on this question alone, I realize, but speaking of the war, to me, as I read through your book, Nathan Bedford Forrest stands out so much more than Robert E. Lee. What does that say about Faulkner's take on the Civil War?
Well, you're right. That Forrest is a figure for Faulkner in a way that Lee is not. Lee is just a name in Faulkner. Forrest is a presence. Now, that's partly geographical. Faulkner's from Mississippi. Forrest had been a Memphis slave trader before the war, and most of his fighting, just about all his fighting, was really done in Tennessee and Mississippi. He's the great local Confederate military leader. And some of his battles were fought within 50 miles of Faulkner's home. Lee is this figure off stage. Forrest is somebody who was known in Faulkner's world. The other thing to say, though, is that Forrest was in essence a war criminal.
Yes.
Who let his men slaughter Black Union soldiers who'd surrendered.
Fort Pillow, yeah.
Who was a slave trader, who was one of the early leaders of the KKK. That Forrest is somebody in whom we see, I guess I'll say, in whom we see the Confederacy naked, without the veneer of good manners and gentlemanly breeding and education and courtliness that you find in Robert E. Lee, and that is part of what made the image of the Confederacy palatable to later generations of people, both North and South. You embody it in Lee, who seems in many ways so much like an English gentleman. And you begin to, you know, it starts to seem palatable. You look at Forrest. I don't know if this is what Faulkner is doing consciously, but I think it is the effect of thinking about Forrest. You look at Forrest and you see the racism and the power relations and the property relations. You see that naked. And if you some of the stories in which Faulkner brings Forrest on stage, almost as a folk hero, are pretty unpalatable. And the more you know about Forrest, the less you're going to put up with that.
Yeah, no, I thought the Forrest's role in the Civil War and the nakedness that Faulkner goes after that makes him a great writer really fit together. Yeah. So we've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much, Michael. This has been absolutely fascinating. I want to thank you for being my guest. This is Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This is episode number 38. Why We Should Read Faulkner Now. My guest, Michael Gora, he's the author of The Saddest Words, William Faulkner's Civil War. You can find more information about this episode by going to my latest blog posting at https://emotionswizard.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. To check out other episodes of my podcast, you can go to my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com. Finally, I like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. In light of today's topic, I've chosen a quote from Shelby Foote, who said, "The Civil War defined us as what we are, and it opened us up to being what we became, good and bad things. It was the crossroads of our being, and it was a hell of a crossroads." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.